So I had a conversation today with my spouse, Joss, that I think you might find interesting.
Shoot.
We were discussing, what it's the holiday season. We were discussing what that looks like, going into the holiday season. Do we want to do something Christmas themed or just holiday themed or something, in general, what that looks like? And I was thinking, last year, I mean, which is, I say last year, I mean, this podcast has only been running since January of 2023, but we did do a Christmas Carol in February. So I'm proposing live on the pod that we do our Christmas episode in February this year. And so I was wondering if you had a pitch for me of what we could do. You could pitch it live on the pod if you've got an idea. Joss is being presented this for the first time. This is not a drill. So if you've got an idea, Joss, Christmas book outside of Christmas Carol, we can talk about. Go.
First one that comes to my mind is Christopher Moore's holiday classic, The Stupidest Angel.
Okay.
But of course, that's kind of a clip show of his work. That's kind of a best of. It's a
Okay.
it's a, it's the Marvel's Avengers of his stuff. What did y'all have in mind?
Well, someone did ask me once if we were going to do the Bible, which is insane. An insane question. Of course not. But I was just imagining you just did the nativity story from every. That would be incredibly presumptuous. Anyway, I wanted
We'll
to
break it
throw
up into
that out
multiple
there.
episodes. We'll spend like a couple on just like genealogies alone.
I think that's a good idea. No, I so putting that out there. If listeners, if you've got an idea for what our Christmas episode should be in February, send an email in to thesocialistshelf@gmail.com. We would greatly appreciate that. And without further ado, let's get to the music.
Listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.
Welcome to the Socialist Shelf, the show where we're still trying to figure out what we're going to do for Christmas in February. It is me, Jacob, as always, with Joss. And with us today, we have a very exciting guest, Carlo Yeager Rodriguez. Carlo, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, Carlo is Carlo. You do Podside Picnic. I know some of our listeners might know Podside. I know you're a writer yourself. People might know you from none of us want to be known from Twitter, but people might know you as Managed Shrimp Diplomacy. If you might be familiar. But Carlo, how you doing today? What possessed you to come on this podcast?
I mean, you guys approached me to talk about, you wanted me to bring you a story,
That's yeah.
and in all honesty, the story that sprung fully formed my mind that I wanted to talk about for, the holiday season is a story that is a horrible bummer.
Sometimes that's how it's got to go.
I mean, what's I don't know if I would call it a bummer, right? You get to light the sea on fire and watch the sunset at the end,
Oh, I mean, could you imagine having like completely immersive VR civilization, Civilization 17 or whatever,
Just
Good.
nuke
You
Antarctica
are
once in a while.
Caesar. Yeah, you are
Yeah.
Caesar,
You
and
still have Sean Bean's voice over it. It's completely immersive, but you just still have Sean Bean being like, "What is man?" Oh man. Well, today we are talking about the short story, The People of Sand and Slag. Super excited to talk about this. This was on sort of a short list of recommendations from Carlo. I picked out basically like the name sounded cool to me. the story ended up being cool and interesting, and we're gonna have a lot to say about it. But Joss, I think you've got an author bio for us. Before we get into it, Carlo, what made this author stand out to you as somebody that we want to discuss?
So, Paolo Bacigalupi had like a really a very interesting and I think awards laden run of short stories. I want to say he was like around like from the mid aughts, like 2005, 2006, up until 2009. Then he had the his first novel that sold. He by his own admission, I think he'd written like four before that that did not. And that one was called The Wind-Up Girl. And anyway, he has a lot of themes that have to do with like ecology. He loves to sort of delve into a lot of sort of like biomechanical or bioengineering type stuff as part of something that is happening in his stories. But this one is like one of the first ones that he came, you know, sort of roaring out the gate, I believe. And I'm trying to look it up right now, but I believe it won, I believe, the Hugo and the Nebula for the year it came out, which was 2004. But Hugo Award for Best Novelette and also the Nebula. Oh, and he got onto the Locus Awards, which is another, you know,
Oh, yeah.
award as well.
No doubt.
But yeah, like a lot of his stuff is just fascinating because it is it melds together all sorts of different things into this type of story that generally is sort of very anti the way things are going right now.
Sure. No, that makes
Yeah,
sense.
he I've seen a couple of interviews that he's done, a couple of interviews and a couple of talks that he's given. He describes himself as an extrapolationist. This was interesting to me, right? Because I mean, the way he frames it, right? He's like, well, you know, if you say you're a YA writer, people kind of look at you funny. If you say you're a science fiction writer, sometimes people might look at you funny and have like misapprehensions about what you write. Of course, he does both of these things. So it gets him thinking, okay, well, how do I describe it in a way that he said that Margaret Atwood described herself as she doesn't want write aspirations. She writes something else that means stories. But the word escapes me, right? But he came up with extrapolationist kind of that, and like he's a writer of accidental futures, right? Not necessarily it's speculative.
Accidental futures.
Yeah, you know,
Interesting. I like that.
it's speculative, yes, but it's speculative in a way that you know, it's not dystopian, but it's not a perfect machine of a world in one sense, which is hell for the protagonist in another. But like it's a setting that's knocked off its axis, right, in ways that people and systems in general in his settings are still struggling to adapt to. And that really caught my eye.
That's
Yeah,
interesting.
that's it truly is an interesting approach because by I think I was just listening to an interview that he gave with the Speculative Fiction Foundation, I believe it's called. And he mentions that you know, like, I mean, this is a message story. Let's not beat around the bush. This is
Sure,
a message
sure.
story, but it is not a message story in his own words, where it's sort of like trying to hit you over the, you know, look, well, I'm paraphrasing what he's saying, but hit you over the head with like its message. He just sort of like shows you this, oh, this is how humans are. You know, they're basically, you know, they've basically become sort of like a singularity creature, but bio enhanced in a way. And he shows you what that looks like. And I mean, honestly, he tries his damnedest for you to not come away going like, you know, like the meme with the rocket going over your head. It's like he doesn't want, you know, he doesn't want that to happen. He wants you to understand that, yeah, this none of this is cool.
Right. Yeah, working as hard as possible not to have like the syndrome where like people identify with the character or something like or not, or if not identify, you can identify, but like don't walk away saying like, oh wow, that was good that that happened, you know, like we hate dogs here or something. Spoiler alert.
Like he didn't try to make like the dog be like a layered metaphor for some marginalized or oppressed community where, you know, at the end of the story, people walk away going, oh shit, sucks to be a dog.
Yeah,
they don't make the connection, you know.
Yeah, you know, it would suck to be anything on that level of on that level of existence. It sucks to be a living creature in this world that isn't, you know, juiced up in some form or fashion. It also skillfully sidesteps the maybe I haven't read enough vampire fiction, but like, in the back of my mind, right, I'm always thinking, man, if I was immortal, right, if I just, you know, had to subsist on blood, you know, and whatever else, and the only price was not going out in the sunlight, I could have so much time, right? Mm-hmm. So much time. I could take 10 years off and learn Icelandic if I wanted, right? And I think Paolo Bacigalupi really gets into the, he really gets into the trade-off of such an existence, right? To be freed from the passage of time, we are forced to assume, to be freed from hunger, to be freed from pain, disease, you know? I mean, yeah, perhaps, but we're freed from a whole hell of a lot else in terms of human and non-human connection.
If I was a vampire, and my only stipulation was I didn't go out to the light, I could learn Icelandic in 9 years. I just want to say.
Your
thing is cool too, though, I guess.
You're a 5 minute abs guy.
Yeah, 9 years for me. Josh said it would, you would take 10, but you know, just want to note that. But yeah, absolutely.
I'm a 5 year abs guy, so yeah.
Okay, 5 years. that's a pretty reasonable goal, yeah, right there. I'm not gonna do it, but it's a reasonable goal. Okay, Joss, well, I think you've got a, you know, you we were already kind of getting into it, but let's, you know, let's learn about our author here some.
Yeah, I got a little bit on him. He's born 6th August 1972. He's about 10 years younger than my parents are, in Paonia, Colorado. Tiny, tiny town. Yes, Gilo. Tiny town, about 1,100 people. It's about 1,500 people today. Not a whole lot of people there. Oberlin College is where he got his degree in East Asian Studies. And in particular, that influences his early work. I think his first is his first book that's set in a kind of near future Thailand.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about Wind Up Girl?
Yeah, something like that.
Well, not well. As we established, his first book that people, anyone that sold that.
Yes.
But which I mean, is... quite. That's not an uncommon thing, though, for your first book to not really be your first "quote unquote" book. I mean, when I was 12, I wrote Rising, and that will never see the light of day. if anyone, God, I hope so. But yeah, go on, Joss.
So yes, he's an interesting guy. Like, he's not only a writer, but he's active in environmental, not only a writer of fiction, I should say. He's active in environmental circles. He's written in Paonia's newspaper, High Country News, right? Both short fiction and essays on environmental politics, and in particularly water politics, right? There's a good talk on YouTube that he gives at the University Bookstore in Seattle, where he discusses a drought conference he was at and that sort of influence on his writing, right? Denver was in the middle of a terrible drought at the time, and it came up in conversation with a researcher there. Oh, you know, how long could the city last in such conditions? And the response was, well, you know, a lot would happen in that time. All the trees would die. It could go on for a while, 5 years probably. And Bacigalupi asks, okay, well, how likely is that to happen? The response was, well, it hasn't happened before. Which
that's one way of looking at it.
Oh yeah, yeah. Which kind of I like this that he came away with it. Like, he thematically, he likes black swans, as he calls them, right? He likes outliers that challenge our established assumptions and theories about the world that we inhabit, you know. Slag and Sand, of course, is such a story in ways that we'll get into. So his first published short story was February 1999's Pocket Full of Dharma. It ran in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, placed 23rd at the Locus Awards that year. 13 years later, it was translated into Japanese and it won a Seiyun. And this and 9 other early works of his would be collected in Pump 6 and Other Stories, which, Carlo, you mentioned, in 2008. That collection also won a Locus. People, Salt and Slag, Sand and Slag, of course, came out in February 2004. It was his third published short story. Got a Hugo, got a Nebula. It made the Locust poll. I don't think it won the Locust. He's nominated for, yeah, his career is pretty award laden, especially in the beginning, as you said, Carla. He was nominated for, he was a finalist for Hugos and Nebulas pretty much right from the jump. And his first award win is a Theodore Sturgeon Award in 06 for The Calorie Man, which this was interesting to me. Nobody's ever won that award twice. Yeah,
Interesting.
people have been nominated for it, like, several times. Paolo Bacigalupi himself has had four noms, only one, though. He wins two Locuses in 09 back to back for Pump Six and the collection in which that novelette appears. His first novel, Wind Up Girl, came out the year after. He wins his other Seiyun for that one in 2013. And the year of its release, he wins a big trifecta: Hugo, Nebula, and a John W. Campbell Memorial Award. It's a big year for him. He also gets a Michael Prince Award for his young adult novel, Shipbreaker, which is the first in his series. He's in China as well. He's been recognized. The year after that, he got a Galaxy Award for most popular foreign writer. Like, I could go on and on about all the stuff that he's won, but as we've been alluding to, his wheelhouse is basically like late stage capitalism, right? Particularly climate change, particularly the attendant kind of decay of human civilization, and indeed humanity itself as we know it. He's a guy who I would love to just sit down and talk to about the circles that he's been in. Jacob, I couldn't help but think of you, and the conferences that you go to sometimes about AI, right?
Oh my
When
God.
he spoke about the environmental stuff going on.
Yeah, a little bit different, different context. Usually my day job doesn't bleed into the podcast, but yes, I have for my work had to go to some conferences on art that deal with artificial intelligence. And yeah, it there is some interesting bleed over that that certainly occurs there, especially when there's conversation about climate. Because I'll say, and not like, for obvious reasons, not naming any names here, because I do like my job, but there will be like company people who will be like, oh, well, AI will solve climate, and then it'll be like, how? No one will ever say how. Like, it'll just kind of be platitudes, it'll kind of be grand. So I do wonder, like, I it seems like something that would frustrate him. But I will say, to bring it back slightly, Shipbreaker is what I had known from him. I was familiar with Shipbreaker.
Oh yeah.
And that's also a climate change narrative. It's basically a I don't know what year it's supposed to take place, but I know New Orleans is gone in that book.
Yes.
And there's a lot of washed up oil tankers and stuff. Hence the Shipbreaker, people trying to survive on the Gulf Coast.
It's similar to American War in that aspect, isn't
I would say it's a lot different than American. No,
it?
in that aspect, maybe alone. American War has just been on my head because of that one trailer that came out for that like A24 movie.
Oh, God.
Carlo, have you read American War?
No, I have not. What is this?
Okay, so it's a novel about not to like sidetrack too much, but it's a novel by Omar El-Akkad about a 20 the 2070s and 2080s of a massive war in the United States. And it's basically like a unified Northern Africa, Middle Eastern state called the Bouazizi Empire, like, is like meddling in American affairs. And it's basically like kind of like a reverse, like American meddling in the Middle East comes home to roost, kind of. Omar El-Akkad wrote it. He came on the podcast, was a really remarkable guest. It's funny because there's just like a lot of American war vibes recently. It's like I can't help but escape. So yeah, like I was saying, that one movie that everybody was like kind of clowning on Twitter was like American War without any of the like anything that made it interesting.
Guy who's only read American War, getting a lot of American War vibes from this.
Yeah, that is us. It's like that or President is Missing. Everything is connected to that on this podcast.
Hey, Olympus has fallen, okay.
True, true. Well, we have Left Behind as well. We reference that sometimes.
Oh wow,
Oh my God.
I never I have never I try I tried I tried reading the first one. It is
I
wow.
made Joss do it. It
Yeah,
Joss.
and to continue this derailment, because it is the type of book that specifically the type of thriller specifically writing that has like Jim Johnson, all 6'5" of him, blue eyes and blah blah blah, glinting and like,
The main
okay,
character's
thank you.
name is in Left Behind is Rayford Steele. It's awesome. It's so funny. But you know, I would say, you know, this the something like the it is interesting. That's an example though of, you know, to side of kind of force a connection that I actually think is worth examining. That is an example of a book that lacks all subtlety. The writing of, you know, the writing here, like in the people of Sand and Slag and whatnot, in this in its own way lacks subtlety, but we actually like it's interesting because there can be, it's not necessarily bad to lack subtlety is what I come back to. It's like a thing I used, I guess like freshman year in college, I was like, everything has to be unbelievably subtle. You have to hide every narrative. Like, but no, that's actually not the case. But there is like a good way of being not subtle and a bad way of being not subtle. Or maybe to put a finer point on it, there is like a good way of being not subtle, and there's just an annoying way of being not subtle. And I guess Left Behind and President is Missing and other books that Joss and I have had fun making fun of on this show, that we have not liked, unlike this work. They fall into that other category. But it's interesting because, like as you said, Carlo, like this text does not want you in the slightest to be mixed up about what its intent is, or what it thinks, or what it's getting at. Neither does Shipbreaker, or I haven't read anything else, but it works. And we can kind of get into why it works. But Joss, I know we kind of interrupted your bio, or I kind of interrupted your bio.
No, I kind of interrupted myself too,
Fair enough, fair enough.
like
So it
but
goes.
yeah, no, like he and you know, he in terms of like subtlety, right? You know, Bacigalupi doesn't shy away from those sorts of Aesop is not the right word. He doesn't shy messages. He doesn't shy away from those sorts of messages in his work. Like he talks about his Shipbreaker series in this other interview that he did for Grist, right? And he's asked, you know, if, is there a positive note? Well, some of the kids survive, right? You know, the message of this work is basically, you know, welcome to the world that we're handing to you kids. I hope you get through it. Right. You know, he's very unflinching about the horror of what he portrays, even if he doesn't directly portray it, even if he's a little more subtle about it. You know, again, Sand and Slag, right, is good at that, right? Because it doesn't linger on a whole lot of imagery. And what imagery it does linger on is you're meant to sort of look around in the margins of that and be like, okay, so what does it represent that we can light the sea on fire, right? You know, it's you can take it at face value, or you can scratch a little deeper and realize, oh, wait a minute, this is profoundly messed up, in ways that we'll get into. He wants to write another book, I think, in the Shipbreaker series called Seascapes. He mentioned in
Okay.
that Seattle interview.
How long ago was that interview? Like, is this a ongoing thing, or is this kind of or is this like the second book of the guy who wrote Battle Royale that we were talking about?
Let's see. The Seattle one was in 2015.
Okay,
So he's
okay.
actually written a thing since then. Maybe that's what became Tool of War.
Okay.
But yeah, he's still active. He's written
He's on Blue
efficient.
Sky. He left Twitter after
He
the
is on
Musk
Blue Sky.
takeover.
Yeah, Twitter redirects you directly to that.
Oh,
Which,
interesting.
yeah, which, you
Yeah.
know, good for him.
Well, he'd also left Twitter because of other things, which we can talk about later after we talk about the story. One thing that I can probably add to the bio
Please
that
do.
I was trying to find like a like where it was, but I distinctly remember Bacigalupi himself in some interview saying that after he won the awards for Sand and Slag, he got like a phone call from Harlan Ellison out of the blue.
Wow.
And Ellison was like, "Yeah, don't let them trap you in. Don't let them trap you in the genre. Just get out."
That's pretty funny. I mean, would you say that you feel like he was trapped in the genre, or is this just where he's comfortable? Like, is this just kind of his pocket?
I mean, I think that like Ellison obviously is a very provocative figure throughout his life, right? I think that he himself felt and much like Vonnegut, I think, who did not want the genre label, you know, protested, you know, doth protest too much, right? Harlan
Sure.
Ellison did. But at the same time, he's not wrong in like if you narrow the channel a little too much, you can end up just being just like just lobbing those easy outs, you know, just getting in that lane and just like cracking them out, churn. And I think that he had to take a step. It felt like he took a step back after Wind Up Girl. There was a little bit of backlash because of that. You know, this was like around 2009, and some of the questions regarding, you know, like whether it was correct or appropriate to for a white author to write other ethnicities and so on and so forth. And that became like a big problem. I mean, it still is, I should say. Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing conversation. I don't think it's ever been solved in any way, shape, or form, you know, because mm-hmm. publishing at its roots, you know, systemically is very white. So.
Yes. Sure.
But you know, that that didn't mean that he did a bad job, I felt, but you know, mm-hmm. that's probably neither here nor there. And that's at this point, I think he also took a step back from like social media as a result of a lot of those conversations and how sort of acrimonious they can get.
Oh, understandable. When I found him on Twitter, he stopped. I guess maybe he had a return because he was posting on Twitter as of like October. But then he said, like, I can't handle this website anymore. I'm going to Blue Sky. And I don't know if he's on there or if he just said he was going to there. But that's where I like to see if, like, when, you know, I feel like we so rarely, it's not true that it's rare that we talk about a living author, but like so often we talk about authors who aren't living or don't have much of a presence. And like when they do have an online presence or whatever, I always find it interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, what is just kind of coming out like this, just like the casual thoughts of this person?
He's posted a lot about the writer's strike.
Yeah.
You know, he's very pro union in that sense.
I would be very surprised if he wasn't, given what I know from him. But let's get into this story, unless Joss, you have anything else outstanding to say about
not a whole hell of a lot else. My first thought when Carla, you mentioned him kind of stepping outside of his wheelhouse or not letting himself get caught in one or another genre. He did dabble in fantasy. He wrote The Alchemist and the Executionist with Tobias Buckle, and that's on my radar. I'm planning on. Maybe I'll read that over the vacation. Yes, the story. People of Sand and Slag.
So do we want to do a little, I mean, it's a pretty simple story. I think a lot of it is the style in which it's written. And it has like a weird, like at least three different styles.
Yes.
That it sort of shifts and morphs through. So essentially, you know, we come to learn that these super biologically modified super soldiers who apparently work at some mining concern sense an intruder, and they basically go out, you know, they tear out of their bunkers because also they're bored as fuck.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing can hurt them. They're effectively immortal. They just get bored real easy as a result. And so they tear out of there. They momentarily just, sort of bicker about, well, we could just drop a mini nuke on it and head back home and you can finish your game or whatever.
They mean really a mini nuke. They will just launch nukes in this world. No problem at all.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. And what they end up finding after everything's said and done is a bedraggled, half dead, starving dog, just matted and just gross. And they just look at it and they go, holy shit, it's like finding a dinosaur. Right. That's actually like the words out of someone's mouth. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the story is them trying to figure out like what's going on. What's up with this dog? How did, you know, they sidestep like it surviving and they're like, well, you know, they sort of dialogue between themselves, and there's several different, not several, but they're the three different characters argue about, you know, why pro or con keeping the dog. The story ends. You could certainly, before you read the story, you could just go on doesthedogdie.com and look up this story.
I feel like once you start this story and you see that there's a dog, like I immediately was like, all right, I'm going to go ahead and brace myself for this one.
yeah,
like,
yeah.
I didn't know for sure, but I had a pretty dang good feeling.
Well, I mean, so one of the things that struck me, and I do, you know what I want to do? I want to read a little bit, if I may.
Please do.
Of the beginning, right? So it starts as like this. Hostile movement. Well inside the perimeter. Well inside. I stripped off my immersive response goggles as adrenaline surged through me. The virtual cityscape I'd been about to raise disappeared, replaced by our monitoring room's many views of CESCO's mining operations. On one screen, the red phosphorescent tracery of an intruder skated across terrain map, a hot blip like blood spattering on its way towards Pit 8. Jack was already out of the monitoring room. I ran for my gear. I caught up with Jack in the equipment room as he grabbed a TS-101 and slashbangs and dragged the Impact's exoskeleton over his tattooed body. He draped bandoliers of surge packs over his massive shoulders and ran for the outer locks. I strapped on my own exoskeleton, pulled my 101 from its rack, checked its charge, and followed. Lisa was already in the HEV, its turbofans screaming like banshees when the hatch dilated. Centaurs leveled their 101s at me, then relax as friend-foe data spilled into their heads-up displays. I bolted across the tarmac, my skin prickling under the blasts of icy Montana wind and the jet wash of Hentas and Mark V engines. Overhead, the clouds glowed orange with light from CESCO's mining bots.
Mm-hmm.
So,
sorry, go ahead.
No, and as you can see, it starts off with this very... very much, I want to involve in the kinetic prejudice, mm-hmm. extreme kinetic prejudice against the intruder.
Yeah, it's almost a trick, right? Like the opening is almost, I mean, trick is the wrong way, but it opens on a tone that it's not going to keep. It opens on a very like, a very
military sci-fi.
Over sci-fi. Like mm-hmm. I almost like the first few paragraphs, I was like, oh my God. Like I was like, if this whole thing is like this, this is going to be a slog. And not because it's bad for the first few paragraphs, but I'm like, I thought I've read stories where like the whole thing is like that. And I was just like, well, what are we doing here? Mm-hmm. Right.
The people of sand and slog.
yeah, exactly. Right. But then you get into it, and then obviously, you know, but it has to start off like that because that is these people's world. That is Jack mm-hmm. and Lisa and Chen's world is, and it's no wonder they're so fucking bored. Like, you know, they exist in this world of like military tactical and stuff and waiting around in a cold, icy Montana wind. Mm-hmm. I wrote down like my opening notes, like along with characters' names were just, let me see, what did I write? Oh, it is Montana and it's cold and it's future. Like, and it was like, okay, but that's all they have. It's Montana, cold, future. And they're just kind of around. And it's like, and they have an interjection of something I would say real or something authentic or something or something not sterile into that.
This was interesting to me. So Carlo, you pronounce it Jack. Jake, did you Jacob, did you pronounce it Jack as well?
Jack was what I was going with. What did you do, Jock or something?
You could have, you know, but
that's yeah, I was doing Jack.
Yeah, I honestly couldn't decide because I read this twice in preparation for the show, and like the first time in my head I read it as Jack, and the second time I read it as Jake because you know I'm a sucker for those like you know long A sounds, and that was interesting to me, right? Because you get right away the sense of the sort of side grade of humanity. Like I mean, they talk about evolutionary dead ends toward the end of the story, and I had that in mind the second time around. You know, it's something familiar has become alien, right? In this case, the name, right? It's spelled differently, but it's pronounced the same.
It's honestly giving like orc NPC I have to make up as a DM. I'm like, yep. This is Jack, and he's big and has tattoos. Like,
wait, no, it's the Star Wars extended universe, Luke.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes. Oh, because he had the clone with like the extra U's. Yeah.
There you go. Oh, see, if you're a clone, you have to have an extra vowel sound.
Ah, yes. You should. Yes, I mean, it would confuse the rest of us.
Yes, I have this directly from Jacob's clone, Jakub. But yeah, no, it's a side grade of humanity, right? It's not they haven't necessarily progressed As we'll come to find out, despite all the differences in their, physiology and capabilities, right? Which was interesting to me, right? Because the very next note that I have is about them flying out to meet this enemy, right? And what do? They fly over a lake, they hit land, and this bit here, the Hunter lurched as its anti-collision software jerked us away from the roughening terrain. Lisa overrode the computers and forced the ship back down against the soil, driving us so low I could have reached out and dragged my hands through the broken scree as we screamed over it. So that right there was interesting to me. If you've worked retail, listeners, right, half of any retail job, speaking from my experience, is figuring out how to work around the constraints of software commissioned and implemented by people who will never use it. And same basic principle here, right? You know, Chen, our narrator, and Jack and Lisa fly super low over the terrain. They turn off the anti-collision software because that countermeasure makes them less able to hunt effectively. So despite them being, you know, in their element, right, they're constantly in search of ways to overcome this this alienation from their world, right, and from the actual contours of living and existing in it.
I mean, yeah, they even complain about their boss.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's this constant rebellion of this strange future humanity against new bizarre technological fetters, but also, you know, stuff that's very familiar to us.
Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely correct. It's an early signal that they are completely like these. They seek out risk, like, yes. and like just wild levels of risk that you or I would never engage in, because like right, I think like within the next paragraph or maybe the next sentence, they jump out of the Hunter, their aircraft with their exoskeletons, and part of the maneuver seems to be that the exoskeletons basically shatter and provide chaff, interference for any enemies that are trying to target them. But also, like, Lisa just jumps and like has a complex fracture, just like bones sticking out of her leg.
No problem.
And part of the thing that's the beauty of the story is that it shows you that. And then she limps up sort of in the midst of healing up. And that's where it clicks. You go, oh, they're like modified to like just heal, like have super healing or something. Mm-hmm. And then he adds that detail where they're sort of shimmying up the ridge line, and Lisa wipes the mud off her face and eats it, and you're like, oh wait, what?
Yeah.
That's where you start later, a little bit later, when we get into like the second part of the story, is where we get to talk a little bit about the Weevil tech, I should say. I was about to say evil tech, but no.
I mean, go ahead. You know, Freudian slip, but they are you know, you. I'm like, you know, imagining like it's like a society of like, you know, Wolverines or whatever.
Yeah,
like
or Deadpools.
Yeah, they heal rapidly. You know, there is to kill someone, you'd have to completely annihilate them, like blow them to bits. That's presumably what they would have to do to anything that was coming in, and they automatically assume it's some kind of, they say, bio job, which is somebody cloned something, grew something in a lab, sent it their way. Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, the dog. And I like the description of the dog before you realize it's a dog, because it says, and I'll quote now, down in the valley, the bio job's headlong run slowed to a trot. It seemed unaware of us. Closer now, we could make out its shape, a shaggy quadruped with a tail. Dreadlocked hair dangled from its shanks like ornaments, tagged with tailing mud clods. It was stained around its legs from the acids of the catchment ponds, as though it had forded streams of urine. And, you know, that, and I remember, like, when I was reading it, I was, like, trying to picture, I'm like, okay, what does this thing look like? Like, I'm trying to piece something. And then, of course, they say, that's a dog. That's not a bio job. And then I was like, oh, of course it is, you know, but like I had this like vision in my head of like some, you know, monster that I was cooking up. But of course, if you didn't know a dog, you know.
Well, but I think that's part of the skill here, right?
No
that
doubt.
He's displaying that he's alienating you from something that is very everyday. Like if you own a dog, you know, like that's a dog. You wouldn't have any doubt in your mind if you saw it, but he's kept you at arm's length because he's embodying, you know, Chen and Jax and Lisa's, you know, like viewpoints, and they don't know what the fuck it is. Like, I think the ongoing joke, like their version of it, they fly now in this, is that's a bio job without hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a line that gets repeated a couple of times, even by the somewhat, we're supposed to think initially the somewhat, kind-hearted perhaps biologist that comes out to check on the creature, which is something that did either one of you watch, I'm gonna guess yes, but District 9?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
I actually didn't.
Oh, you haven't? Okay.
I have not.
It's great. But Jacob, the beginning montage of interviews where even the supposed people that are helping the aliens of the story sort of like become part of the community, call them by what you would imagine is a very bigoted name, which is prawns. Uh-huh. And it just reminded me of that, because it's like, yeah, this is, he just sees the dog as like something to research. He doesn't enjoy the dog for what it is.
It's the reverse ET, right? Where the scientists come in and you're like, oh, they're terrifying. And then the scientists actually do care about the alien to some capacity or something. And they actually, whatever, which again, I mean, neither here nor there, but one of my favorite choices of a quote unquote villain in almost any movie ever. But it is that. This dog, they're like trying to figure out what to do with it. And they're like, well, is it going to heal? And like the dog, and this is where you get another scene of like the dog bites down hard onto Jack's arm and like is like ripping it off. And he's like, oh, looks like I got me a pet, you know? And if at this yeah, point,
it's very, very Looney Tunes, right?
Yeah.
I almost imagine silly. Like, oh, you look at him. He's like,
yeah. And the dog's like going around and around.
Dangling off his arm.
There is that very, very casual relationship to violence and dismemberment that, you know, that sort of immortality engenders, right? I mean, earlier, right before you get the scene of them doing the jump, right, and they take that damage and they're healing from it, Lisa has a bit about, yeah, you know, like it was either go swimming or rip off your kneecaps to alleviate my boredom. And yeah, once you're into this, you're like, oh, she actually probably meant that.
Yeah, that wasn't hyperbole. She would have just ripped off her kneecaps to alleviate boredom. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. No, go ahead.
But yeah, they I like, well, I note this line where it says, must be a bummer to wake up and find out you're at the end of your evolutionary curve, because just, you know, in this unclear amount of time in the past, at some point, humans transcended the need, you know, evolutionarily for any other species, and all other species died out because, as we'll note, they can exist in zoos. They can exist in places where they're sort of allowed to exist. And this dog, and we don't know how, they throw out a few theories, has managed to exist in this land of sand and slag. Now, what it's been eating, we don't know. How it survived, we don't know. It certainly is not doing very well for itself. We can, you know, imagine, well, what else is out there? But for all intents and purposes, for as far as we know and these characters know, this is the last living wild animal on Earth. And it might as well be, whether or not, you know, that's literally the case in the mind of the author, you know. And that's what we're dealing with. These three meatheads have found the last wild creature.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like that's it becomes sort of like an emblematic thing, right? For like within even the context of the story, you're supposed to take away that you know, like they've injected themselves with like that weevil tech that allows them to regenerate, you know, like immediately, like almost immediately from almost anything, right?
Yeah.
It's telling that they didn't do that for any animals or nature. It was to basically to separate themselves from nature, and they have that little what is it, that poem or whatever? It was like,
oh yeah,
I swallow poison, and you know,
I am God alone.
I am God. I've swallowed poison and blah blah blah. I've swallowed science. I am God alone.
Yes,
and I think that alone part is the real sort of heart that is somewhat hidden from you for a long part of this story. The fact that there is a stunted, but there is a heart beating in Chen, at least in Chen.
mm-hmm. Well, and as well, you know, Weaveltech as, I mean, because it's sold to the public through, you know, songs and education, right, and PR, right, as this evolutionary next step, right, and the story leads you to challenge that, I think, because it's I was thinking as this toward the end of my second read through is that okay, so. I was kind of grappling with what a biojob actually was. Like, is it a repurposed human? Like, were these centaurs once human? No, I later found out they're essentially like horses given cybernetic upgrades and
Well,
sentient
I
upgrades.
think it's not that they took the animal and upgraded it. I think it's that they sort of made something new. Like
A
they use a
chimera
kit.
type.
Yeah, I
Like a
think it says
chimera
they
type
even
kind of
use a
lab
kit. Like
grown.
they said, 'cause at one point it said get some building blocks and make something if it makes you happy. Something with hands for God's sake. Right? So that implies that that implies that they're sort of creating. They're creating it, if not from scratch, then basically, like I'm imagining, like they've got little like different sand and soup and molds, and they're just throwing it together. And
Which
ultimately, like
essentially.
it's not wild and it's not real in any sense that this dog is. But
It
like,
obviates the need for beasts of burden.
yeah, no, it's true. It's interesting that I also think about I also think about like the environmental background, of Bashkalupi and his concern. And I often think about, talking about conferences, talking about like the people talking about how humanity can adapt to climate change, saying things like, "Oh, well, if we do this, we'll make it," or "Well, humanity won't." It's one I've heard. Humanity won't go extinct, and it's like this kind of idea of like, and okay, say that's true. Say I believe you. Okay, well, what will and how many humans and what will we sacrifice and what will be destroyed in the process? And I think that's what this story is challenging, where it's like,
That's
well,
exactly yes.
we passed the evolutionary curve. We're good. We made it. And it's like, yeah, dude, and you eat sand.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, what will we
Well, and
sacrifice is exactly the right question.
well, and like it sounds corny if you put it into this like tagline, but this is a story where man's best friend has been alienated from man.
Yeah, completely.
Or if you wanted to use, humanity, let's put it that
Yeah.
way, right? The fact that, and this is something that he plays with, right? It's let me put it to you this way: it's as an effect as effective a metaphor for the reader as like the child in Omelas, right? Because it's an innocent creature that doesn't deserve anything that happens to it, but somehow you're supposed to be like, well, that's the world.
That's
Like,
just how it is, yeah.
and I think part of the skill of like I think we were talking about earlier, like the messaging, like there is a message here, it's obvious, but it isn't one that you're told because that message is completely embodied in the story itself. It doesn't feel like it's coming from outside, it's just coming from their viewpoints. And at the end, you feel sort of like a pang because like they're just so stunted. It's
Yeah.
that moment where you're like, man, you're so close. So close.
And that's what's good about putting you so firmly in this world from the very beginning is that it forces you to experience that and feel that stuntedness. One could see this story from the outside in a way where where you don't have that internal understanding, where this becomes a lot less easy to understand. You're just kind of watching it and it looks you don't understand the internal conflict or what that even looks like or why there is an internal conflict, and where the humanity is in any of it. But they do, but they have to debate over what they're going to do with this dog, plot wise. They run its DNA, they figure out, okay, it is a dog, it doesn't heal. They accidentally break some of its bones, putting it in a cage, obviously it makes you cringe, like, oh my God, this poor thing.
Yeah, because I mean, and that's sort
And
of
they don't
like,
know. Yeah.
yeah, and it's just like horrifying because you realize that since they don't have, like, to a certain extent, they've made themselves like Cenobites. They experience pain as pleasure, as something that at least is different than whatever happened before it, right? Sure. And so therefore they can't identify pain in other creatures. And that's the thing, like you're sitting there and like you think, Jesus Christ, you broke the fucking dog's bones. What the fuck, man?
Oh yeah. I mean, this is a people that they allude to it going on in the cities, right? And you know, these trends of, oh yeah, we'll have parties where we mutilate each other. Oh yeah, like it's this kind of a kink thing where you cut off somebody's limbs before you sleep with them, right? Mm-hmm.
This is set in the world of crimes of the future, yeah.
Oh, man, pretty much. Yeah. That. There's a blink and you'll miss it kind of thing in the beginning of the second bit here, where they're talking about their body modifications, right? How they cut Lisa's skin and like set blades in her arms, right? Chen's got a glow spine or whatever. Jack or Jake or Jacques did all of his modification, the story says, with an old time scar and tattoo shop in Hawaii, which was interesting to me because like that the Hawaiian tattoo tradition, I was reading a little bit about this for some character design work. Their tattoo tradition goes back literal centuries, which is the sort of thing, I mean, that sort of thing still exists in this future is, I mean, to me, that testifies to incredible resilience in the face of insane exploitation and erasure. I mean, you know, you look at Hawaii now, right, where kids are still disciplined in school for speaking their native language, where the U.S. military is currently poisoning the water table, and you transport that centuries into the future, and then you think to yourself, oh, wait, but there are vestiges, there are aspects of that culture that still survives that you know, people are still interested in. There is that brief moment of... I don't know if it's hope, but I think it's just Bacigalupi noting that, you know, these things like the dog are harder to completely stamp out than one might think. You know, whether or not they will survive in the long term is another question entirely, but they do go on surviving against all odds.
That's so something I thought of.
Let me toss something your way that just occurred to me. Because as I was thinking a little bit more about, you know, like the idea of like man's best friend, oh, poor little guy. But like from a more materialist type of viewpoint, outside of like those first stones, like the stones that were used for weaponry and whatnot, wouldn't dogs be one of our first tools that we shaped to our specifications over time?
Yes.
Yeah. And in the materialist sense, yeah.
Yeah, and like he's literally saying that we've outgrown our one of our oldest tools, basically. It also comes to mind that the half dog, half man guy from Shipbreaker is called Tool.
No way. True.
Yeah.
Oh that's man, true. Well now I have to read that.
It's great.
As opposed to cats who allegedly domesticated themselves, if you believe that, that's legend. Yeah, that's true. But that's exactly right. That the dog is no longer of, you know, use to humanity, but also nature is no longer of use to humanity. So it has been completely cast out. And there's even this idea of like, well, we have like preserves of places you can go. And presumably you can go inside this, whatever it's called, holodeck and like experience whatever you want to. Now, what does he experience in these video games? He experiences bombing Antarctic refugees, which like it's a bit of, you know, it's horrifying, but it's a bit of humor because it's so over the top. But it's like this world is so like just to feel something, I'm going to bomb some Antarctic refugees, you know. And obviously even the term Antarctic refugee makes you ask questions.
Recessionist is the word that he uses, which I mean, we don't know what it means in the context of that setting, right? But
critical support to the Antarctic secessionist movement, probably.
You know, for all I know, they were all activists trying to, you know, disrupt the shipment of the Antarctic tar sands.
It's possible, you know. And I mean, it notably, does it even say what they're mining at any point? Is it just like
so?
I mean, they're mining something that's valuable. That's going into space, but
yeah, it doesn't really matter.
Exactly,
I feel. So this is the part of the story that Bacigalupi's been sort of like public about the fact that this story came from when he was writing for, I think it was the High, what is it, the High Country News?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He came across like a story about this dog that had been found, like in, you know, like just inconceivably had survived living in like this, the center in the middle of some mining operation where it's just like, just full of runoff and tailings and just gross shit, just poison. And that was sort of like the thing that got him thinking is like, oh shit, this is a story I could write about.
Yeah. And I mean, I saw people I saw people online saying, and it's absolutely an insane take. They're like, oh, I wish this was like a full novel. And I like disagree, you know, like this world exists perfectly, I think, in this chunk that we're given it, you know? And the story of the dog is able to exist in this world in a way where if it got too overexplained and it got too overwrought, and if we knew, well, the dog was eating this bug that managed to, no, I don't want to know that, you know? That doesn't do anything for me. That doesn't help me, you know? The sort of curse of world building he manages to avoid here to a certain
extent. Well, I think that also we're supposed to hold in our minds the dog as sort of like almost symbolic,
yeah, no doubt,
as well, right? Because everyone else is in the story. Like, again, let me read a little bit, because this, as I was rereading this, I was like, damn, man, this biologist is really callous.
Yeah.
Notably,
like the biologist gets brought in to like examine, is this a real dog, and like what can we do with this?
And he's like, oh yeah, you broke its bones or whatever. It's because it describes it as like just lying there inert and breathing heavily, and you're like, okay,
yeah.
And then they mention, oh, it didn't eat or drink anything, it was just lying there. You're like, oh shit. Because you know what that means for a dog. But I say, what is it, they're talking to the biologist, and he says,
the biologist's name is Lynn Musharraf.
Yeah.
And you can look for it if you need to.
Yeah, he says,
Lynn Manuel Musharraf.
Oh my God.
No.
Get the hell out of here. Okay.
Essentially, he says, like, oh, our furry friend, we don't need him. I have the blood sample here. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd be too expensive to take care of. And, you know, like, I already have everything I need. So do whatever. And like, wait, you're not going to take it with you? You're like, no, in fact, you could eat it if you want. In the past, it was a delicacy. You know, I know I could send you a couple of recipes from the old times. And you're like, fuck, man. Mm-hmm. And granted, I understand that can be a delicacy, but like,
if it's the last living animal, well, no matter the animal, that's a wild thing to say, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like hunting down the last, you know, dolphin and going like, let's make a steak.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, they're interested once again in the utility, this biologist, which it's interesting, when the biologist shows up, these characters kind of look at him with suspicion, and it, which makes you think, okay, finally the good guy's here. But it is a world of pure utility. You know, the thing they look down on him for is having like a brain implant that lets him remember more. And they're like, well, that makes you less safe. You know, we could easily incapacitate you with that.
Well, yeah, Lisa is always the one in the group that is ready to just go aggro at any moment.
Oh, yeah. She wants like, to kill everybody.
Oh, yeah. I could crack your fucking brain implant. What's going to happen to you then, huh? Smart guy. You're like, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah. She's definitely like the big, strong soldier lady that the internet would, of course, be completely normal about.
She is the one from the beginning that like she's got like the razor blades implanted in her skin and stuff, which like is a cool like image, a very metal like image. Literally like metal up and down her. But like that and the fact of the matter is, to keep the dog alive, and this is notable, they have to actually sacrifice some of their own money and time too. Mm-hmm. Like, it is a sacrifice, which it's like notable that sacrifice just doesn't really seem to be of something like that. Doesn't seem to be something that they've ever like thought of. Like, they seem to live in a company town of some sort where they work for mostly room and board, and then a pittance that lets them buy trinkets, basically. You know, trip vacations, which a vacation is easy because you zip across the world to some desolate landscape or another, or a new video game, or new tattoos, or new metal to shove up your spine or whatever. That they don't need anything per se. I mean, what do you need? Food? Like, no, you'll eat the dirt, quite literally. But but there is a sacrifice of, well, you have to trade off these material things you want to take care of someone. Well, they don't have these concepts like family. They don't have these concepts like certainly a pet. They don't have these concepts like, well, I'm going to trade this to get something else. Like, while their lives are hyper transactional, the idea of like a non-economically minded trade or sacrifice is just so beyond them that when Jack is like, okay, yeah, this is kind of cool. He even has to frame it as a, oh, well, people will be jealous or think I'm cool or whatever. And then that's, you know, cause they can't quite, they don't quite got the concept of like love or affection or even like curiosity to a certain extent down.
And Jacob, well, sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, Jacob, and you have the answer right there to Lisa's question earlier, right? When the dog is, you know, when his bones are broken, when they put him in the cage, and Lisa's like, wow, you know, so he breaks and like he doesn't heal. Like, how did they live long enough? How do we live long enough to evolve out of that is her question, right? And of course, you know, the answer that you allude to right there is, you know, the collective, it's community, it's altruism, it's the desire to take care of those around you, right? Which, to my mind, is where the real horror of the story lies. It's, as you say, you know, we've evolved beyond that, you know, quote unquote evolved, right? You know, it's in making individual humans totally like physiologically, like biologically self-sufficient, self-healing. You can eat anything. You have infinite options for entertainment, that sort of thing. You know, the cost of reproducing your labor is basically nullified, right? You're turned into constant capital under the system. And unlike our hardware, unlike our software, right, it requires no maintenance. We are automatons at this stage.
And we can eat dirt, like literally.
Yes.
Sand and slag. Yeah, and that's all that's left anyway. You know, you're not getting a lot of descriptions of greenery or whatever. So it's a good thing. Good thing that we can't. You know,
well, I mean, it's sort of funny that they have turned them like they've weirdly reversed like the threats. You remember the nano machines, gray goo threats? They've reversed it, right? They've made the earth into gray goo, but they could eat it. It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. It's good, actually. You know, and fry up a little sand.
And like to Joss's point, I feel like this is the type of future where like Randian like selfishness has just taken like the very American idea of Randian selfishness being a good thing has taken root so deeply that like you said, they have no concept of like, well, this costs something. Well, fuck that, you know, get rid of it. I don't need that.
Right. It extrapolates out like if that Randian model somehow worked in some quote unquote sense, if there was able to be a society that worked on its logic and continued to function and the gears continue to turn without, you know, just everything breaking, including humans, it would require this level of extraction. It would require this level of removal of emotion from the process. And this is what we'd be left with. And it would be, you know, by the interior logic of like that Randian conception, it would be quote unquote worth it because the prophet would continue. These are the strongest beings who've ever existed. They're as gods. They are Atlas, like amazing. They're awesome, right? Well, no, it sucks. And anyone who has like, you know, a brain could tell you it sucks. Yeah. But it forces you to contend with that. You know, forces you to live in this world where I can easily imagine them being able to eat sand, you know. I do like, you know, shortly after this, they have this moment where the dog, they teach the dog how to shake hands and the dog is like licking their face. Like there's these moments of, and that's when I knew the dog was fucked, right? if I had any doubt.
What did they call the dog? Dead meat.
Yeah, exactly. They start talking about this book, you know. Our Chen starts, y'all quoted it earlier, but I'll read it again. It's a poem that says, Cut me, I won't bleed. Gas me, I won't breathe. Stab me, shoot me. Slash me, smash me. I have swallowed science. I am God alone. And this is from this last poet who essentially refused to take genetic modifications, and he died of normal cancer because he would not become God alone.
Right. And I think that that's reflected back to us when I think it's Chen that has like this conversation. I think it's with Jack where he's talking about like, yeah, there's something there. Like Jack is like saying it's not really smart. And he's like, not like us smart, no, but there's something there. And he's trying to, like, that's the first glimmer you get that Chen is sort of having like this, something's awakening in him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just briefly, right? Where he realizes that alone part is starting to really,
yes,
sting. Because have either one of you read Te Ching? Specifically,
he wrote the book that Arrival was based on, right?
Yeah, it was a novella or whatever. Yeah, yeah. He has a story called The Great Silence, and it's all about like it's this beautiful description of like the then at the time functional Arecibo observatory where SETI, you know, and it's told from the point of view of a Puerto Rican parrot, and Puerto Rican parrots are endangered. Just so you know, they're coming back slowly, but they're still, you know, it's still slow going. And it's told from the point of view of this parrot that's sort of lamenting that here you are, look at this dish. You're spending so much effort to try to communicate, you know, with aliens. And here we are, you know, and it's something that resonates with this story, you know, where he's sort of like figuring out that there's also something to being vulnerable. Right. And showing, and he has that glimmer, and it's by the end of the story, it might still be there, but the dog is not. So
it's as close to like, cause they never name the dog.
No, they don't.
I have a kind of a theory of the end of the story that I want to introduce, but I kind of want to just finish off the description of the plot in a little more detail before I do that. Cause that's a great point. Basically they go on a quick trip to Hawaii for a swimming vacation. You know, we get to see you know, the limitless horizon of black waves and fire and petroleum jewels. And, you know, you have very interesting, you know, quick, you know, it doesn't go into a whole lot of detail in the sense of like it's spending, you know, endless paragraphs describing the scene, but it'll say, Lisa was a good swimmer. She flashed with the ocean's metallic sheen like an eel out of history. And when she surfaced, her naked body glistened with hundreds of iridescent petroleum jewels. So, you know, a very efficient, a very efficient way of kind of showing this fucked up world, but also how you could see beauty in it. And, you know, then you have this, you know, it's not super important, but you have, you find out that Chen and Lisa have this thing that they apparently like to cut off each other's limbs and have sex with them, so that would like they're in a more submissive position or whatever. Or Lisa's trying for the first time, and she even notes, and I guess it's the only time that Lisa ever seems to have anything for the dog. She's like, I kind of get it. I'm a lot like that dog right now, and the fact that like I'm kind of weak, and for another few hours I'm not going to be able to like move because I don't have arms or legs or whatever. I don't like it. This sucks.
Like, this is what you've evolved to. You've literally just gained the ability to do Guru.
Yeah, it's essentially, yeah, that's and you know, it's meant to be, you know, another dash of kind of like body horror, of course, and I mean effectively so. And also, but then the dog gets itself hurt. It says
I have it right here if you want.
Yeah, please read it. Yeah.
The dog got tangled in a cluster of wire our last day on the beach. Really ripped the hell out of it. Slashes through its fur, broken legs, practically strangled. It had gnawed one of its own paws half off trying to get free. By the time we found it, it was a bloody mess of ragged fur and exposed meat. Lisa stared down at the dog. Christ, Jack, you're supposed to be watching it. I went swimming. You can't keep an eye on the thing all the time. It's going to take forever to fix this, she fumed. We should warm it up in the Hunter, I said. It'll be easy to work on it back home. Lisa and I knelt down to start cutting the dog free. It whimpered and its tail wagged feebly as we started to work. Jack was silent. I want to stop there because, like, this is like the last couple of last couple of pages of it.
And that's where basically they're like, well, this thing is a pain. It takes actual work. You have to literally clean up after it. You have to make sure it's safe, you know, as Jack failed to do so magnificently. You have to make sure it's water and the air it breathes, because the air is so inhospitable. You know, not lost on the reader, I would hope, that you know, certainly wasn't lost on me when I'm reading it, that like, oh wow, yeah, that stupid dog that can't survive breathing the air, wonder who did that, you know. As if it was not, you know, humanity that made the air unbreathable. You know,
there's a guy in a banana suit that's trying to find who did
yeah that. We're all trying to find the guy who did this. Exactly. And it's, and you know, they're all like, well, I like the dog, but like, I want to get a new tattoos. Well, I'm trying to get a new game. And then you have, we all looked at each other, then down at the dog, and it immediately cuts to Lisa roasted the dog on a split over burning plastics and petroleum skim from the ocean. It tasted okay, but in the end, it was hard to understand the big deal. I've eaten slagged centaur that tastes better. It's like, oh, come the fuck. And I'll read to the end here. Afterwards, we walked along the shoreline. Opalescent waves crashed and roared up the sand, leaving jewel slicks as they receded and the sun sank red in the distance. Without the dog, we could really enjoy the beach. We didn't have to worry about whether it was going to step in acid or tangle in barbed wire half buried in the sand or eat something that would keep it up vomiting half the night. Still, I remember when the dog licked my face and hauled its shaggy bulk onto my bed. And I remember its warm breathing beside me. And sometimes I miss it. And that's the end. Just says end. And
worth noting, I mean, they themselves don't have to. First of all, it's interesting to me that they still use Christ as an expletive. Like, religion is, I mean, this is our world, but like far ahead. Presumably religion has survived in whatever like vestigial way, you know, even if it's just like,
you
know,
say, language, oh my Ford.
Verbal to
the brave
even if it's
world,
just verbal
yeah.
ticks, a. But also, like, what I notice here now is, you know, they don't have to worry about themselves doing these things, right? They don't have to worry about them stepping in acid or getting tangled in barbed wire or eating something that they keeps them up vomiting, right? And you know, in that sense, sure, it's more convenient for them. But what the dog has that they don't is a sense of revulsion, right? Mm-hmm. Is a sense of, you know, it knows, it feels pain. Right. It tastes, you know, terrible things. Its body knows to reject things that are inimical to it. Right. Which is what makes it, you know, which is what makes it a living creature. Right. It's, you know, to go back to the stuff about, you know, cutting off somebody's limbs and then having sex with them. Right. It's that sort of masturbatory self-harm is effectively their only entertainment, right? Mm-hmm. Their only relationship with pain is that, you know, there's no struggle essentially because they're nothing to aspire to. They have found a niche in which they fit perfectly. And the only way that they can sort of break free of that is, you know, literally just mutilating each other, right? That's, that's the real evolutionary dead end in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. Like it's funny that they're sitting there on their lofty pedestals, you know, calling this and that an evolutionary dead end. And really, like if, you know, like Jacob was reading, like there is beauty to be found, right, in this world that's poisoned and polluted and just completely undone by human hands. But that's the thing, isn't it? It's a beauty wrought only by human hands. It is not something that exists outside of humanity. And so therefore we don't need, you know, it's the equivalent of looking up into the sky and seeing a mirror, you know?
Yeah. It's a grand, we are God alone. I mean, and it's notable, like, and it doesn't go into it too much, but I mean, these characters are hired to be security. Like there is still violence and fighting and war in this world. Like it has not, those contradictions have not been resolved, right? Humanity hasn't destroyed the earth and now made a truce with itself. Like they're still hiring these guys to kill and sending bio jobs at each other. They still have nukes, which they will drop at a moment's notice on the place they live. You know, Lisa even notes, like, oh, this is the closest I've come to death outside of combat, because like there is that concept of you could be totally annihilated. So like that violence, you know, that the evolutionary dead end now, like, yeah, they are a dead end and they are fighting over this blasted world. But what I wanted to note about, like, yeah, they kind of have this, or at least Chen kind of has this melancholy at the end about the dog. But given that this is sort of, let's see if I can put this right. This is this dog being the last wild creature, presumably the last vestige of non-human, in whether that be just human infected sand, human infected air, whatever, in on the earth. This was sort of the last chance to extend an olive branch to anything outside themselves, anything outside just their own obsession. In a sense, killing this dog is like the Mark 3:28 unpardonable sin. Like, it is the moment of, like, even if there is guilt for it, you have now stepped past any, there is no healing what has been done. Like, you know, even if Chen spent the end of the story like, what have I done, I'll spend the rest of my life atoning, well, there is no atoning. The atonement is they have, you know, presumably it, that is the last thing. And could humanity have atoned for its sins by them raising this dog to own a old age? Well, no, like the sins of humanity are stack higher than anyone could ever comprehend. But there was this chance of this, like, moment of, like, the tiniest glimmer of light. And I think the real damning thing about humanity in this story is that these characters are able to see that glimmer of light and choose against it anyway. They are not machines. They are not robots that cannot choose. Like, Joss, you said they become perfect automatons, and that's true. But they continue to choose to be those perfect automatons, and that's where the real, like, horror of the story is. And damn, yeah.
Yeah.
Sucks.
They
Sucks to live in this world, gotta say.
you know, they've in breaking free from the chains of hunger and disease and all that, you know, they've effectively reforged them into these different fetters that, you know, keep them from the experiences that we know as human, right? And I mean, the line, what did they say before, right? This jumped out at me. Mud makes us tick, right? You know, they live on, you know, the, you know, they just eat, you know, mud or whatever, right? Which, to my mind, it's an interesting deviation from the idea in myth that we're formed from the earth, right? We're formed from clay, right? It's this ironic repurposing of a creation story for an existence totally devoid of stories, right? They have access to bits and pieces of what it once meant to be human, but there's no real way to synthesize them into this way of understanding what we used to be, right? It is that one line from Spy Kids that, like, goes way harder than it needs to. Like, you know, do you think God stays in heaven because he too fears what he's created? Like, in raising us,
the Steve Buscemi character in Spy Kids too,
you
yeah.
know, and in raising ourselves to the level of God, you know, what have we found out? We found out that there's no heaven for us to escape into, right? This is all there is. I mean, you could effectively rename this story, My Brother in Christ, You Made the Sandwich.
Right, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Well, it sort of it definitely ties into the fact that we're supposed to think that this is definitely a profaned world. Like, this
Yes.
is a completely fallen world in the sense that we demolished it.
Yeah. And profane in the sense of, I mean, it was, as we alluded to in the Crucible episode, right? Not even necessarily like it's just like gross and like there are swears, although there is certainly grossness and there are swears, but, you know, there is nothing more that is sacred. You know, there is nothing
That's
more except the it's perfectly Randian and utilitarian, you know, and there's nothing beyond it.
yeah, and I think that the dog itself, amongst many other things, is just supposed to be like a glimmer of that sort of like the sacredness that they have missed, right? But they've not known it for so long that they don't even know that they miss it.
Yeah, you know, the ugly is made, if not beautiful, then acceptable. You know, the wasteland is made, you know, I wouldn't say the wasteland is made beautiful as in they're sitting there like, oh, the poetry of no, they're just not thinking about that at all. That's kind of been knocked out of their heads. Not because they can't, or not because it even, you know, seems to be in any sense like banned or whatever. Like they have poetry. They're able to readily access it, it seems. It's just the alternative was given and humanity made the wrong choice over and over. And this is like the last wrong choice, basically.
It's more Fahrenheit 451 than it is 1984.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. The minute you were talking about the choices, it's one of the things that I come away from. Like I thankfully I never read Fahrenheit 451 in school. So I never got drummed into my head that it's definitely about censorship, because, you know,
yeah,
the curriculum's to make things easy for teachers. And don't get me wrong. Sure. I love teachers. They're great, mm-hmm. but they have a lot of work on their hands. So sometimes, yeah. You resort to shortcuts. It can
be oversimplified, yeah.
And generally speaking, what I came away with after reading it was that this is sort of it's similar to 1984, except that it's a completely market-based solution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the logic behind it is very simple. And granted, this is mostly the book is mostly Fahrenheit 451, at least, is mostly about Bradbury being grumpy about TV. but the fact
he's really good at being grumpy about TV.
Oh,
that's
no,
matters.
It's great. It's great. And the logic, the economic logic that he structures behind it is so good because, well, people love their TVs, so therefore they don't need to read books. So therefore, but and we've also fireproofed all these houses, so books are now a danger. You should just get rid of your books. But if you don't want to get rid of your books, we have to send the firemen over.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and one gets the sense in this world that, like, while it's adjacent, it's like there, you know, maybe were no firemen. It was just kind of like, I mean, like there was just that encouragement and it was easier. Like, you know, you have the two competing sections of poetry at that one point, right? You have, mm-hmm. I mean, the slight poem we read, and then the
wormy,
other
wormy squirmy in my belly.
Yeah.
Like
wormy squirmy in my belly.
It's like
wormy,
it's like a little
feeds you Nelly.
Yeah. It's like a little bit of child's rhyme instead of like this profound poetry that you read later and you're like, this is how you teach yourself.
Yeah, it kind of made me think of, like, I mean, to quote the third big dystopia, you know, we already name checked two, Brave New World. Like, it makes me think of, like, a gram is worth more than a dam, is better than a dam.
Yes.
The like what the kids get in their heads, you know,
it's the ultimate death of culture, you know, to be replaced by something totally insipid to facilitate, to encourage your you know, the continual deadening of your senses, essentially, you know.
I was just gonna say that part of it that feels very stunted for them is that, yes, they do have a certain cunning, but it's been honed to just one hyper specific task.
Yes.
And they're completely incurious about much of anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the characters are not, and the characters are also not from the outside, like, you know, facing some kind of oppression from an authoritarian government who's telling them, don't keep the dog and whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, no, the government, as far as it exists, I guess the company or whatever, the biologist, is just like, yeah, man, keep the dog. It's going to be a pain in the ass, but keep it if you want, or eat it, mm-hmm. or whatever the hell. Like, they make this call, and they, like, to put like a point on it, like, they are like the final doom of humanity. Like, they are these three meatheads in the middle of Montana who just like freeze their ass off every day, who happen to find a dog, are given this sort of final moral choice that will define humanity. And they fuck it up. it makes me think of, you know, it makes me think of, like, there's a, and I couldn't even tell you what it's called or what it's from, but it was a old animated, like, film I saw as a kid, and I don't know how, it must've been on YouTube or something, or like even an older website, but there was like God, after a guy died, and this guy was a serial killer in life, God saw, okay, well, he had a bad childhood, I'm going to give him another chance, I'm going to give him another life. And God just kept setting out situations for him to do one good deed and God would forgive him. And it wouldn't matter. And the joke of it was, the guy, no matter how ridiculous would find the way to make the wrong call. Like, God, I wish I could remember what it's called. If I do, I'll put it, I'll link it in the episode because it was quite funny, or at least it was to me when I was like 10. It'd be like, there'd be like a squirrel that was injured and all he had to do was not like jump over the street to like jump on it. But he had to, like, that's kind of the vibe you get from this. I mean, it's less, but, and I was going to say less slapstick, but there are actually moments of like slapstick. Like, they're cutting each other's limbs off and hanging out on the beach talking about should they roast the last living wild creature alive. Like, yeah. It's, but you well, know, the horror, that's the horror and the comedy of it.
Right, right. Like even the part that I read where it's like the dog was all tangled and it's,
yeah.
If it weren't for the fact that he continues the description, like the visceral wounds and stuff, it would be funny because like you almost hear the little, you know, like the little goink, 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 you know, like sound, you know, like you're supposed to, it's supposed to be darkly comic, but at the same time, like, yeah, like to a certain degree, it's also like horrible. I mean, most jokes are horrible if they happen to you, right?
Mm-hmm. That's true. My one of my favorite English professors who he has a new book out. A new book out. His name's Peter Selgin. Look him up. He's a good writer. But he once basically said like talked about a joke and like just told an increasingly ridiculous scenario of what would be a very, very, very bad day. But if you say it in the right way, then it's quite funny. And, you know, I remember he like concluded with it and then she got hit by a bus and we all laughed and he was like, out of context, y'all seem like the worst people of all time. I remember like, you know, but yeah, exactly. So yeah, I mean, like, I don't know, you know, I guess I, you know, not to be like, annoying, like, what can we learn from this? I don't want to like over whatever, but like,
so, I mean,
what is our takeaway? What can we learn from this aside from like, let's not kill dogs?
I mean, I forget who said this. I think it's attributed to Asimov, who said that there are three types of like speculative fiction stories, which is what if only, and if this goes on. Right. And this is definitely the last one, right?
If this goes on.
Because I mean, like, he's obviously got a very firm grasp of, okay, if we just like continue mining and extracting resources from the earth,
mm-hmm.
you know, for as long as you can, this is the future that we might see, except that of course the speculative aspect is that, you know, we will probably not be given any of the weevil tech.
Sure.
Only the billionaires will get that. Mm-hmm.
There is one mention precisely of aesthetes in New York and I believe LA, like you don't have to work, right? There is this class of people that still sits above, you know, passively profiting from what, you know, these people are doing and protecting, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing that that you reminded me of is there's a total alienation from, you know, it's the ultimate going to work and not talking politics with your coworkers, right? You know, we don't have a sense of what shape the United States is in. We don't have a sense of global geopolitics except for this or that war that they've fought. There's some war in the Kamchatka Peninsula that they mentioned. It is irrelevant to them. It is irrelevant to the story that Butch Igalupi is telling, because presumably we have evolved beyond effectively removed ourselves, or the ruling class has removed has managed to excise politics from humanity, right? They've managed, it's the ultimate siloization of the individual.
Yeah, this is definitely like, because of that loneliness, you end up accelerating like this idea of hyper individualism, which is why they can't possibly connect with another creature that needs something from them.
And not for lack of something beyond their ability to describe resonating with them, right? You know, they still, Chen still has that regret. You know, they still, Jack still has that moment of, oh, I taught this thing to do this thing. Isn't that cool? You know, I mean, having grown up with dogs, you know, as the owner of a cat now, you can see her. Hi, Shiloh. There is a sense of companionship that is very hard, if not impossible, to you know, to breed out of humanity, to program out of humanity, you know. And I mean, the real tragedy is not that it's gone necessarily, but that it's there and we just can't appreciate it.
I come back to, you know, this is a memory that occurred to me, listening to an audiobook of Elizabeth Colbert's The Sixth Extinction while I was washing dishes at Chili's. And my boss, you know, not really my, like a manager, comes up to me. And he says, he's like, what do you listen to? I get talking and I'm like Sixth Extinction. And I'm telling him, like, you know, talking about the book. And he's like, but we'll be fine though. And I was like, well, no, probably not. And he's like, and he was like, well, that's kind of what I'm worried about. And I'm like, true, fair enough that, like, obviously, you know, you and yours, your family, your life, understandable. But that's like the underpinning logic of this world is like the, but okay, so we're going to kill everything, but we'll be fine though, you know? And so, yeah, that kind of logic cannot, I mean, it cannot, we cannot survive it. Nothing can survive it. That cannot be allowed. That cannot be what we walk forward with. We have to have a view of the world that is more complicated than, you know, plain profit and also plain efficiency, plain like, well, I'm going to make a, you know, I'm going to make the perfect human, or I'm going to make, you know, we're going to be able to, every animal needs to have hands because why wouldn't you have opposable thumbs? Those are awesome. Or, heck, even on the, front of art, I'm going to make a video game that's as realistic as possible. So realistic that everyone just lives within it. And then you can, and bomb people and get work everything out completely guilt-free. You know, that note was kind of interesting to me, that idea, like these different concepts, like that is what we kind of have to work beyond. And that's what we have to understand. You know, that's how we achieve a world that is, that's how we don't become the people of sand and slack. I'll put it that way. Let's not become people sand and slack people, please.
Like, yeah. I think, my last takeaway would be, in order for you and I and everyone to go outside and touch grass, we need to have a place for grass to grow.
Yes. Brilliantly put.
I can't put it better than that. So, Joss, do you have any other thoughts? Cause if you don't, then that's perfect.
Yeah. I mean, you know, politics and, you know, science and the business of creating a world for that next generation to grow up in, you know, to leave the next generation something more than just, oh, well, good luck, as Bacigalupi alludes to, you know, you have to treat these things as, you know, something more than a curiosity, right? You have to actively evolve yourself in them, because otherwise, you know, the best you can aspire to is, you know, you are the biologist Lin-Manuel Musharraf who just looks at something and goes, oh, remarkable, until it dies. Lin-Manuel Musharraf. Welcome to the people of sand and slog. They found a dog. Sometimes I go to the toilet and there's a clog.
Oh my God.
Oh no.
Joss,
oh no.
God damn it. I take back everything I said. We should just nuke it all. Carlo, we really appreciate you coming on today. Is there anything you want to plug? You want to tell people about what you do?
Sure. I am the main host, along with co-hosts Kurt and Chris, and occasionally others that show up on Podside Picnic. You can find that at patreon.com/podsidepicnic. I also write. Currently, the only thing that I had, I mean, my only fiction piece, I should say, that I had published was published in Strange Horizons around July. It's called Up in the Hills. She dreams of her daughter deep underground. Wow. Deep in the ground, I should say. And that's
it's
about
quite
it.
Good. I want to say, you know, I don't mean to embarrass you, but I I read it. It's excellent. So,
well, thanks
highly
for reading
recommend.
And thanks for that. Very kind.
Absolutely.
I just googled it. I'm gonna read it right after the
go for
we actually, me and Joss went on Podside to talk about the video game Binding of Isaac, because we were like, you know, we've kind of got our niche hammered out here with literature, but we're like, you know, there are no rules when we go on guest pods. Like when we went on Worst of All Possible Worlds and talked about the children's radio drama Adventures in Odyssey. We went on y'all and talked about Binding of Isaac. You know, call us on. We have other interests. We don't just read. It's just mostly. But no, yeah, we really appreciate you coming through. We also appreciate Kurt, him doing a Snow Crash episode with us a few months back. But
this one's not quite so hefty as that one.
That's true. It's true. But, you know, there's like definitely connections that can be made between the two. But I'll leave it to the listeners to make those connections in their minds and me to do it afterwards and wish I had made the point instead of like forcing connections between totally. ET and this.
And I'll say about Podside as well, like the sheer breadth of content y'all get into, sci-fi, fantasy, across all genres and mediums, right? It would take me, I would have to take a year off just to go back through and listen to it all. I do want to call out specifically the Superman episode that y'all did with friend of our show's Aaron Thorpe.
Like he's great.
Yeah, the way that y'all discuss Superman, the 1970s film specifically, you know, and relate it to, you know, the immigrant experience and growing up in America, like it's not a character until that episode that really interested me, but like you've definitely pointed me in a direction that I didn't even know was there. Thank you.
Eric came on our show also to talk about Octavia Butler's Blood Child collection, and that was a lot of fun. Joss, do you have anything you want to close it out? If please, for the love of God, not another Lin-Manuel Miranda bit. No,
that was my only bit.
God forbid, I will edit every line out of this to make it.
I mean, once I get that Lin-Manuel Miranda like Chinese Revolution musical off the ground, you know, you'll be eating those words.
That's deep lore. Yeah, you have to go way back to understand that reference. But well, then we'll just say thanks again for coming on, Carlo, and everybody. If you meet a random dog in the wild, just you know, call the local animal shelter or adopt it yourself. But you know, it can't taste that good. It's not worth it. It's never worth it. Have a good one, everybody.
Peace out.
Listening to Socialist Shelf Radio.